The experiment that we're going to be starting today is an experiment related to the freezing point depression of water. Freezing point depression is one of a number of colligative properties. They're properties of a solution that depend not on the identity of what gets put in the solution, but it's how many particles that generates, and it has something to do with the solvent itself. So we will be coming up with a physical constant, or water. But since we are doing a lab that involves solutions, I wanted to just review some terminology related to solutions first, just to make sure that we all know some of the essential definitions. I guess it would make sense then for us to begin with a definition of the word solution itself. I alluded to this in lecture today, though, that I would like a definition that does not involve solute, solvent, dissolve, or anything with S-O-L in it. So could anybody give me a definition for solution that doesn't have any of those sol words? Yes? Good try, but that's kind of just cheating and using alternate terminology. But okay, it's two things that are mixed together, right? Well, we have another term, mixture. What, a mixture being two things that are mixed together. What kind of mixtures are there? I couldn't quite hear you. But there's some classifications, and I think I heard someone say them. Yes. Homogeneous and heterogeneous. Yes. What is the difference between a homogeneous solution and a heterogeneous solution? Homogeneous mixture or heterogeneous mixture? Can you give me an example of either one of them? It's been a while since 1A, hasn't it? I'll give you an example of one of the two, and you tell me which one it is. What happens if you put salt into water? It disappears in the water, right? It gets to where you can't tell that there's any difference from one part of that mixture versus another. And that's exactly what a homogeneous mixture is, something where the components, once they're mixed, you can't separate them physically and you can't easily identify that, again, one part of that mixture is different than another. What would be an example then of a heterogeneous mixture? So you'll have to speak a little louder because we have this air conditioning system that makes you all sound like this. So a nice loud answer from someone. Yes. Sand and water. Yes, because you could mix the sand water up really quickly. Let's say back in our childhood days when we wanted to make sand castles, we might have done something like that. But even back then, we would notice that after a while, if we just let the bucket sit, that the water and the sand are going to separate from each other, which means they are a kind of mixture, but one that separates physically, and that is a heterogeneous mixture. But let's go to a homogeneous mixture again of salt and water. Because isn't that also what a solution is? A mixture in which you can't identify that one part of that mixture is any different than another? That means that a solution is nothing more than a homogeneous mixture. What then is the solvent? Again, avoiding the use of any sol words to define it. Yes? The substance that's in greater quantity. And I notice you were correcting yourself because, yes, there are solutions that aren't just a solid put into liquid. An easy alternate example would be a liquid put into liquid. For example, I mentioned ethanol and water, I think, in lecture today, and ethanol and water can be mixed in any proportion, but both of them are liquids. So, in fact, which one you call the solvent and which one you call the solute is a matter of perspective. And in that case, the solvent would be the major component of the solution. What would the solute be? The minor one. If one's the major, one's the minor. What about the word soluble? How could we define that? Well, I'll make this one a little easier. It is to be able to form a solution, but it is dependent on two things: what the solvent is and what the temperature is. So we could say a sentence like salt is water, salt is soluble, but in what? Well, in water. Well, how much is soluble will depend on how hot the water is. So soluble is able to form a homogeneous mixture with a particular solvent. At a particular temperature. Very related to that, dissolve. So soluble is an adjective, dissolve is a verb, so dissolve means to cause a solution to form. To cause a homogeneous mixture to form. You don't even need to ask the question. If we are taking the time to write these words down, they must be ones that I want you to know. So yes, you have to know the definitions to these things on your lecture or lab quiz, because this is a solutions-based lab, so the material is adequate for both. Let's switch our root words a little bit here. How about miscible? What does that one mean? Ooh, yes. It's related to that. It's not how much. That would be its solubility, but it's the fact that you can take two substances and mix them in any proportion. It's exactly like that example of water and ethanol I was giving earlier. You could have 100 milliliters of ethanol and one of water, or 100 milliliters of water and one of ethanol, and anything in between, it will always mix. So miscible means able to form a solution regardless of the quantities used. Its opposite then would be immiscible. An example of that would be, a decent example is oil and water. You put oil on top of water, it's going to form two layers. Even if it's just a drop of oil, it's still going to be rejected usually by the water. So immiscible means unable to form a solution, again, regardless of the proportions, the quantities used. And one more term that is going to be related to something we've discussed in the lab, saturated. Does anyone know what the term saturated means? Yes? A little louder, please. You get to the point where you no longer can dissolve any more of the solute. In other words, you have reached the maximum quantity of that particular solvent that you're able to stuff in that solution, which again will depend on the temperature of that solution. So a saturated solution contains the maximum quantity of a particular solute. In a particular solvent at a particular temperature. So that will be it for the vocab words for the moment. Does anyone have any questions on any of these before we move on to our next topic? Okay, then we are going to start inching towards freezing point depression. But first, we got to talk a little bit about the process of freezing. So let's say that we start with just a pure substance, and let's say that it's water. Water is actually a kind of unusual substance. For example, why is it a bad idea to take a glass bottle filled with water and put it into the freezer? Because the water is going to expand, right? If none of you have ever done this, don't. Because depending how strong that glass is, it's going to break and you're going to have a mess in your freezer. How many other substances are there that have that kind of behavior? Not an awful lot of substances, because usually as you form a solid, molecules are being brought closer together, so generally the density of a substance goes up when it freezes. But water, when it freezes, if it's expanding, that means that the volume is expanding, even though the mass is not changing, so that means its density is going down. Why? What is happening in water when it freezes? There is a type of structure that's formed. Does that, do you remember? There's spaces in it, yes, and they are hexagonal in nature. That's in fact related to the fact that snowflakes have a hexagonal or sixfold symmetry. So water is very unusual because the strong intermolecular forces between water molecules pull the water molecules to this particular shape. And then once ice melts, the molecules are free to move around again, free to then pack more closely, and so it becomes more dense as a liquid. But let's go back to the question I was asking originally, which I partially gave away in that story about water. What is it that causes liquid water to become solid? The intermolecular forces. In other words, at some point, if you have enough attraction between water molecules, which remember our discussion from Monday, water is fairly polar because it's got these polar bonds to it, but it's also asymmetric. And because of that asymmetry and that polarity, it's got strong intermolecular forces. And they can get strong enough if you drop the temperature enough where they hold the molecules together, and therefore you have something that freezes. Ethane, it's a lot more difficult to get it to freeze, meaning you have to cool it down a lot more because it is a non-polar symmetric molecule, and so it has very little, not zero, but very little in the way of intermolecular forces. So you have to remove so much more energy in order to maintain that solid form. But that's what causes something to freeze. Something freezes once the kinetic energy due to thermal energy is no longer sufficient to overcome the intermolecular forces between molecules. Freezing occurs when thermal energy drops to the point that the molecules have insufficient kinetic energy to overcome the attractive forces between them. Now, of course, in the context of today's lecture, this would be the description of a covalent substance, since ionic substances attract by ions. And I was hesitant to write this down in lecture the other day when we were talking about this. But if I wanted to write an improper formula just to get the concept across, here's what I could say. That the intermolecular forces are greater than the kinetic energy. That's not a proper expression because force and energy are different units. So just at that level alone, wrong kind of equation. But the idea is correct. That the grip of the molecules is strong enough to keep them from shaking apart due to the heat, and that's why a solid forms. Well, if that's why a solid forms, why is it that by adding something that's soluble is going to affect the freezing point of that now solution? Which, let me point out that this whole discussion that we're having about colligative properties, it is dependent on it being solutions, meaning homogeneous mixtures that we're dealing with, meaning that that thing that you add has to be soluble. So let's say we do have something soluble that we throw into water. Why is that going to lower water's melting point? That's right. Water does its unusual thing of expanding because of the unique arrangement that water molecules make when you drop the temperature down. And that shape that they make happens to be the best one energetically based on the structure of water. More generally, when substance freezes, the molecules tend to try to arrange in such a way where they're packed as closely together as possible to maximize those energetically favorable attractive forces. So that's why many substances form very, very identifiable, very unique crystal structures. Salt has a cubic structure down at the molecular level, but if you look at a salt crystal under a microscope, it's also cubic in shape. But when you start to put something that's soluble in between where things would want to line up, well, now the molecules are not going to pack together as tightly. Now there's not going to be as efficient stacking of the molecules, which means that there's not as much attractive force between them. Now let me write that much down, or let me draw a picture, and then I'll describe even further what I'm talking about. Let's say that we have two different pure substances, one that happens to be somewhat round in shape, its molecular shape, and let's say that we have something that's somewhat linear in shape. It might be that the linear molecule will stack in one particular pattern that maximizes its interactions, while a circle, because it's a very different geometry, might have a different way that it tries to align to maximize the interaction between them. But now as we make a solution, there may be a much more random arrangement. Exactly whether that will happen or not depends on the amount of the substances used and, of course, the structure of the substances. But this is a general thing that would hold true. The way that the molecules pack together changes. Now, we're talking about freezing point depression, which means we're not talking about the temperature of the solution changing. We're talking about the temperature at which freezing occurs changing. So let's say that we had two solutions at the same temperature. Water, for example, pure water versus a solution containing water. Well, why is it that the solution containing water will have a lower freezing point? Because at the same temperature, it has lower intermolecular forces. which means that it's easier for that heat to overcome those intermolecular forces. So therefore, you have to drop the temperature of water to remove energy from water to make the molecules slow down enough so that they no longer overcome those now weakened intermolecular forces, which means since you had to drop the temperature, that means the freezing point has dropped, and that is the cause, the origin, of freezing point depression. Normally, substances, pure substances, are able to achieve a more efficient packing when forming a solid than a solution. And let me just clarify, because I know the word packing can have multiple meanings. Packing in the sense of packing together, the molecules trying to come as close together into a condensed space as possible. So if this is true, that pure substances have more efficient packing, that means that the intermolecular forces between the components of a mixture is generally lower than it would be in either of the individual substances. Because of that, more energy must be removed so that the solid can form due to the lowered intermolecular forces, which results in freezing point depression. And we will be discussing mathematically this topic of freezing point depression once we have a chance to practice converting between molarity and molality, so get a little practice dealing with molality. Then we'll get to the equations for freezing point depression, boiling point elevation, because they're very simple equations, but they're ones that depend on molality. So I'm going to next move on to our experimental procedure, but let me first ask, are there any questions on what we discussed up to this point? And I see that you're still writing, so I'll pause just for a moment. So can someone describe to me what the physical setup is for the lab today? Okay, we have an ice salt water bath in a beaker. What else?
Testing for
test tube, several different test tubes with water and glycerol. And that's pretty much it. You do have a thermometer that you'll check out. Let me draw a picture of the setup here so we can discuss it a little bit. So we have our beaker, inside of which we have a test tube. That test tube contains the sample, which, yes, is glycerol and water. Surrounding that, we have that ice salt water bath I mentioned. You will have a thermometer that you check out, which you use that both to measure the temperature of the solution, but also to stir it quite vigorously. And we'll talk about just a moment why it is that you have to stir it so vigorously. But let me draw up the structure of glycerol just so we can have a discussion about it. I'm going to write up in two different forms. This is the form that you're probably more used to seeing. A condensed structure. Where on each of those carbons, where I say CH2, it's understood to mean that there's two separate hydrogens that are separately connected to that carbon. Carbon is normally tetrahedral. Or tetravalent, meaning it has four connections to it. So two of the connections in this case are hydrogens. There's one connection from each carbon. The middle structure is incorrect. There's only one hydrogen on it. So all the carbons are at least connected to one other carbon. Oxygen is connected to each carbon as well. There is a simplification of the structure that we do if we're writing organic structures. So this more full structure can be simplified in this way. The reason it's simplified in that way is when writing organic structures, you assume that every point that's missing a label is a carbon because it's an organic molecule, meaning it contains principally carbon. And as I mentioned a moment ago, carbon is normally tetravalent. So if you do not see enough bonds to make that number of connections for a particular carbon, you automatically assume there's enough hydrogens there to make up the other connections, because that's how most organic molecules are in terms of structure. We'll talk more about how to do the writing of these kinds of structures when we get to that brief intro to OChem at the end of the quarter. Has any of you learned previously how to write organic structures? Just a couple of you. Okay. It's not something necessarily taught in 1A or 1B. I tend to do it just because it does make it easier to write anything organic down. Why is it that I wanted to write the structure of glycerol up? Well, because many alcohols are not soluble in water because of the nonpolar parts of the molecule where you have mostly carbons. But this is an unusual alcohol because it is a triol, meaning it's got three alcohol groups on it, which makes it very, very, very compatible with water because it is also something that effectively has an OH group to it. So the molecules are very, very compatible, and that's why we're able to make really good mixtures of these. But sometimes they're too good at mixing, which is a problem that we'll get to in just a moment. What is it about the ice water salt bath? Why are we using this? Because it's going to be something way colder than the freezing point of most of your solutions. What we don't have time to talk about today, because we're going to run low on time, is why the salt bath does what it does. But the short answer is that melting is an endothermic process. And so you're putting ice in that's going to melt. It's absorbing energy in order to melt, and what we're going to talk about is that it absorbs it from the solution, which, since the solution has salt in it, means it gets colder than 0 degrees Celsius easily. So you do need to replenish the ice in those ice salt water baths occasionally, because once you set it up, it is sitting out open in the room, and it's going to slowly melt. As the ice melts, it loses the capability of keeping everything cold enough to make sure that you're going to freeze the solutions that you're trying to measure. So if you see that you're running low on ice, pour out some of the water, which, yes, for these salt water baths, it's okay to pour that water in the sink. So pour the water off a bit, add a little bit more ice. You might need to add a little bit more salt as well to make sure that you see the temperature lowering effect. As far as the solutions, you do want to continually stir them. And let's, in fact, go ahead and address why it is that you have to stir so vigorously. You are making measurements of the temperatures of the solution over time. And in case it's not clear that you need to do so, you need to keep a running track of how much time has passed versus what temperature your solution is at. Now, depending on how quick the temperature change is occurring, you might want to write down observations every 15 seconds. Or you might want to write them down every 30 seconds. It somewhat depends on how concentrated the solution is and how cold your ice bath is. Let's just assume for the moment that as time continues, energy is being pulled out of that solution at a constant rate. So on my x-axis on this graph, I'll have time, but let's say that that's related to energy. And then on my y-axis, I'll have temperature. If I have a pure substance behaving in an ideal fashion, over time, what's going to happen if energy is being removed? Look at the units on the graph. I gave you one of the units, time, and asking what's going to happen. A temperature change, right? You remove energy for something, you're going to make it colder. And the reason I said if this all behaves ideally, and if energy is being removed at a constant rate, it should be a linear relationship between time and temperature, something that would be predicted by the equation that we use for specific heat or heat capacity, that the change in energy is related to change in temperature times the specific heat, with mass thrown in there as well. But if we continue to cool something and it starts to freeze, what's then going to happen to the shape of this graph? It's going to flatten out. Again, in ideal behavior. Because that's where a phase transition is occurring. Energy is still being taken out of the system, but to turn the substance from a liquid into a solid. Once it is all turned into a solid, if you continue removing energy, then the temperature is going to drop again. So we can divide this up into three sections, you could say, where we have a liquid, where the liquid is changing into a solid, and then where we finally have that solid. Now, this is if things behave ideally, but especially as you get to the more concentrated solutions, it's very likely that it's not going to behave ideally, exactly for the fact that the glycerol is so compatible with water. Imagine that we didn't stir it. And let's say that the molecules were really interacting with each other, but let's say that for whatever reason, they don't quite click into the right position for a solid to form. Well, if you're at low temperature, the molecules aren't moving around much, and so you might get stuck in a situation where the temperature continues to drop. You haven't made a solid yet, but you should have. You reach a point where you have more dissolved in solution than normally would be physically allowable at that temperature, which is a condition known as supersaturation. Supersaturation is a condition in which a solution contains more solute than normally is possible. At that temperature. So in other words, in terms of our observations, if we're monitoring over time what our temperature is, we can see a dip that's going to occur because it's going to go artificially below its normal freezing point. At some point, though, if the solution finally clicks into place, if enough temperature or enough energy is removed, or if you disturb the solution, then maybe the molecules finally snap together to form a solid, and in fact, you'd see the whole solution appear to freeze almost instantaneously. What will happen to the temperature when that occurs? It'll go back up. Why? Because freezing is exothermic, and the only thing to catch that heat as it's being released is the solid that just formed. But the solid should have already been a solid anyways because we were below the freezing point of that substance. So when the heat is released back to the system, yes, the temperature goes up, but likely it's going to remain a solid, then continue to cool down normally. So then the graph should come back to the shape we normally expect. The reason we have to worry about supersaturation is that means that if you see a dip like this occur, you're not going to call the lowest point on that graph the freezing point. Instead, it is where the leveling occurs. That is where the initial freezing point is. And you do want to make a note of when crystals just first start to form for each one of your solutions. Because if you did not stir the solutions, what can happen is as they freeze, they will freeze from the outside in. And as they freeze from the outside, some of the solute can get displaced to the inside. If that occurs, that means the concentration of that solute in solution increases, which means the freezing point drops, which means the inside has to be cooled off even more for it to freeze than the outside would. So to avoid that issue, we're stirring, and we're also going to make a note of when that first set of crystals starts to form for each one of your solutions. So just to make sure that it's clear, the data you are collecting today are going to be your time that's elapsed. And again, for simplicity's sake, you might just do it every 15 seconds. So you'll have 15, 30, 45 minute, minute 15, minute 30, like that. And then you're going to be able to work in pairs. This is one of the few experiments where you will work in pairs. I won't assign lab partners, so just choose someone you think you'll be capable of working with. No sets of three, please, no sets of four, just pairs of people working together. I will be looking at your data, so I'll figure out if you did do pairs or not. It would be probably logical for one person to do the stirring and the measuring while the other person is doing the writing and the timing, and then maybe you could swap off duties if you wanted to or got bored with one of them. But that is our activity for the experiment. I will talk next time about preparing the graphs to analyze this data, but we do need to get going with the experiment. But there's just a couple of more notes that I do need to make because I need to come back and talk about your prelabs just a little bit. I did not read them over thoroughly. The one thing I was checking for is whether you would be able to perform the experiment without having to look at the original textbook. So for those of you who had the comment written on there that said quantities, it was because you didn't have the quantities written in your lab text. And yes, I know that you have your original book to be able to refer back to, but our eventual goal in this class is to do an experiment without having the original text in front of us. So for the future, if there is a table that gives you a set of masses or volumes for you to prepare things with, transfer that set of numbers into your lab text. Now, of course, you're not going to sit around all day long trying to get exactly the masses that are mentioned there. So if it says, for example, to get 1.2 grams of glycerol, don't go for 1.2000 grams. You'll drive yourself batty trying to do that. Instead, get really close to 1.2 grams, write down that number, and then that's the number you'll use in your calculations, which as long as you're close, you'll still get the results that you need for this experiment. Glycerol is a sticky substance. It can make a mess. Messes do not upset me. It is failing to clean up messes that upset me, particularly in the balance room area, where all of us instructors have that problem every quarter. So let me ask again, how many of you have looked at the syllabus at all? So there are probably not very many of you that have noticed that where it gives you the breakdown for the grades, 750 points for lecture, 250 points for lab, there's a star on that 250 points with a note that says that that total number of points might be lowered due to a poorly maintained laboratory environment. In other words, if you make a mess that you can't be bothered to clean up, then the solution is to take points off of everyone's lab score, which might seem unfair, except there's only one of me and 30 of you. So unless I install security cameras, I'm not going to be able to catch who did what. And it is everyone's responsibility in the lab to keep the lab environment clean and safe. Now, I don't want that to mean that one kind-hearted person volunteers to clean up for everyone else, because you shouldn't have to take it upon yourself to clean up after everyone else's mess, nor should you yourself necessarily actively go up to someone and tell them don't make a mess. You don't need to get in their face about it, because that's my job. So just let me know if you see someone making a mess that just leaves it and doesn't clean it up. The reason that this matters, besides just common courtesy and the fact that this is not your room, this is our room, it's also that it's an unsafe practice. Yes, right now it's glycerol, but if you have any dreams of working in a research lab one day, you think you're going to stay hired very long if you leave hazardous chemicals just out and contaminating an area? No. I'm sure there's plenty more skilled people that they'd be able to find to replace you, given that there's lots of competition for those types of jobs. So you need to start having good behavior now so you don't get yourself in trouble in the future. And to ensure that there's the good behavior now, I will point out again that in the syllabus it says you will lose points. And since you only need one warning because you're third quarter students, not first quarter students, it will happen today if there is a mess left today. Now, the morning section did just fine, it appears. I did not notice any glycerol that was left behind unless I missed a little bit somewhere. But I did check the balances afterwards, and they did a good job. So it's easy to do a good job because, again, I don't get upset at messes. I get upset if they're left behind. So you do need to clean your mess up as you go. Now, some notes about the glycerol measuring it out. Do not go and fill up your own beaker with your own personal stash of the glycerol, because very likely you're going to take too much, and that means you have extra that you're just going to throw away, which if we had money to throw away like that, we would. But the money that comes to fund our chemicals comes from an entirely different source than what funds all the building going on campus. So we in chemistry are not rolling in cash. So please don't throw it down the waste bottle by taking too much in your own personal stash to use. Instead, you may take the bottles of glycerol, which are in the fume hood over here, into the balance room so that everybody can use them for now. The glycerol is a sticky mess. So once you measure out into one test tube, you're not going to be able to easily transfer it to another one. So you need to make sure to get the mass of the test tube before you start, then get the mass of the glycerol. And if you were paying attention, you know you're supposed to get one more mass, which is after you add the 12 milliliters of water. Now, if you go back to some of your pre-labs, some of you don't describe that measurement process at all. And so I don't know if you missed it or just didn't realize how many times that you need to make mass measurements. But I'm pointing it out because it matters. Because, yes, approximately the density of water is 1 gram per milliliter. But that's only exactly true at one temperature. And who says we're exactly at that right temperature? So, and also, in addition, mass measurements are far more precise than volume measurements. What do I mean by precise? In this case, the instrumental precision, the fact that your balances can measure out to 4 decimal points, whereas most volume measurements you're going to make here have one or two decimal points, and that's it. And since we're dealing with smaller volumes, that matters a bunch. So you should get the mass of your test tube first, or the test tube with the beaker. Now, if you're the type of person that zeroes out the balance, if you tear your balance first, that's fine, but make sure you're still there in front of the balance, because it's going to get crowded in there. So if you put your equipment on there, hit zero, turn away to go get your chemical, come back, someone else might have re-zeroed it already. So to be safe, I normally recommend that you zero the balance with nothing in it, then get the measurement of whatever glassware you're going to use to contain, which don't use a large beaker, because the too big of beaker is too heavy, too much mass for these balances. So you're not using the same beaker you're going to be freezing in the balance room. You just need a beaker to hold that test tube upright so stuff doesn't spill out. So get your beaker and test tube, get that individual mass, put your glycerol in. Again, don't try to get exactly the quantities in the table, get close. Get that mass, then add the 12 milliliters, which is about 12 grams of water, and get that final mass. Go ahead and prepare all of your solutions today, but you won't have time, most likely, to run all of your solutions today. If you check out stoppers from the stockroom, though, you can stopper your solution to prevent any evaporation, and that should mean you should be able to walk in and use your solutions on Monday fine to finish up your experiment. Some of you might be familiar with this wonderful stuff called parafilm. If you know what it is, you should also know that it's not a stopper in its own self. You will have evaporation that can occur through parafilm. So you do need to get a stopper that test tube first. Then, if you want to know, or if you already know what parafilm is, it's something that's kind of like lab saran wrap. It gives an additional seal to a test tube. You can use it after stoppering. The test tubes that you're going to use won't stand upright in your lab lockers. It is in your lab lockers that you need to store your test tubes. So what you should do is just try to lean them on their side, maybe not flat, because it's unlikely there's going to be any kind of reaction with the rubber and the stopper, but in other cases in the future, that might not be true. So better to leave it at a little bit of a tilt, maybe have your sponge in there that you can set them on and have them tilting. But again, I already know, because there were a lot of concerns about that this morning, that they will not stand upright. Again, coming back to the pre-lab, some of you left the space for chemical hazards and chemical disposal. Some of you didn't. I'd like to comment on both of those right now, though. In terms of chemical hazards, you're using water, which, yes, water can be toxic in large enough quantities if you stay underwater in a pool long enough. That is the basis of an urban legend, which I don't know if it's true or not, but there was supposedly at some point a campaign called Ban Dihydrogen Monoxide. Now think about dihydrogen monoxide, water, right? Go up to a group of people in Congress and start complaining about how in your area where you live, there's this horrible problem with pollution due to dihydrogen monoxide. You know, it's found in most industrial waste that's coming out in rivers. It's found in acid rain. It causes death in large quantities. This is water we're talking about. And so if you go to a group of people that know nothing about chemistry and you get them worried about dihydrogen monoxide, they too will take up the charge, the call to get rid of dihydrogen monoxide, until someone pulls them aside and says, you know you're trying to ban water, don't you? So sometimes it's good to know a little bit of chemistry. So back to the chemical hazards. Water, not a hazard. Glycerol, contact hazard, in that it might be irritating to the skin if you leave it on for a long time. Glycerol is one of the components of triglycerides, fat molecules. Triglycerides are made of glycerol that's been reacted and connected to three what are known as carboxylic acids, which are, in biological terms, tend to be very long nonpolar molecules. Join three of them together with one of these glycerols, that gives you a fat molecule. So glycerol in itself is not inordinately toxic. Doesn't mean go drink it. It just means that if you happen to get it on you, if you don't wash it off, it might irritate your skin. And if you do get it on you, don't go running around. Your hand's not going to fall off. Just make sure to calmly rinse the stuff off of you. That's all the hazards that we have other than salt, which presumably you all used table salt. So take the same precautions as you do with table salt. As far as waste disposal, the glycerol water mixtures will go into a waste bottle that'll be appropriately labeled in the fume hood H4 in the back corner over there. There is a bottle already there with my name on it from this morning, which you are allowed to use. We try to segregate waste. Well, we have to segregate waste by the kind of waste it is. But you also should look for my initials when and if there are multiple bottles for the same experiment available. The reason that we want to separate not just by experiment but by instructor is so that if we have some kind of incident occur, we might have an ability to track back and see what happened. Specifically, I'm talking about an incident that occurred once in this room with one of the waste bottles where we discovered it was releasing a colored gas, which not that that's any kind of scientific principle, but it anecdotally holds true that most colored gases are toxic. So not a good thing to have billowing out of your waste bottle. Anytime anything is reacting in a waste bottle, bad news. So if we keep the waste segregated and properly labeled, we can try to trace backwards to see when and how something like that went wrong. So we do have one bottle already back there, but do not fill it up to the very, very, very top. We have to leave what's called head space, because if you take a collapsible, flexible bottle like that, and if it's filled to the absolute top, when you pick it up, if the lid's not on tightly, or sometimes even if it is, there might be enough pressure just from the bottle deforming by the weight of the liquid that you just suddenly lifted that some of that liquid could come pouring out, spilling onto whichever person is carrying that hazardous chemical waste. So we leave a little bit of air space at the top to prevent exactly that. So I'll write a line on there. Please don't fill over that line. Please let me know if we get close to it so I can make a new waste bottle. Don't ever just walk over there and pour waste in whatever bottle you feel like, because we do have things that would be chemically incompatible. So you can't be on autopilot when you're doing waste disposal. That's for the solutions. What about this ice water salt mix? Well, the salt, much of it, is not going to dissolve. And so we are trying to recover what salt that we can, because we don't have a lot of it on hand, and again, trying to save some money. So there's a white bucket next to the sink in the back of the classroom here. That sink, if you notice, has a white handle in the sink itself. That is the source of deionized water for the room. All the squirt bottles that say deionized water around the room, that's what those are. And if you run out of water, you can refill them at that station over there. Next to that particular sink is a bucket that says recycled salt. That is the salt I would like you to use first. It may be wet because there was a previous 1C section that did do this experiment and recovered their salt already. But after you're done with the experiment for today, you're going to take your salt ice water mix, pour off as much of the ice and water as you can, and then dump the rest of the salt back into that recycled bin. So I think I've described the setup, what you're doing for measurement, how to get rid of the waste, and then what the hazards of the lab are. The last comment I'll make is that this lab is out at 5:20. I make the morning lab be out right at 10:20, the equivalent time for them, because from 10:30 to 11:20 is one of the few slivers of time I have a chance to try to go exercise to maintain the battle of the bulge. So because I make them get out of lab on time and like that at them, I'm going to be the same towards you, which means at 5:20, I'm walking out the door, locking it behind me, turning off the lights with the rest of you in front of me already out of the room. I'm sure you all want to go home too, so and I do have it at 6 o'clock appointment on Wednesdays I usually keep, so I do have somewhere I myself need to get to. I don't think it'll be a problem in this class because the experiments aren't as bad, but I think sometimes of the organic class that I teach where they have very long experiments, and each quarter that I start a new class of organic chemistry, I usually have to threaten them to say that every minute that they are there after lab is 1 point off of their lab report. And when I tell them that, boy, they are out on time. The reason they end up late so often is because they have long experiments that some of them don't prepare properly for. But we also have people in any chemistry class that are OCD. And it's okay for me to talk about it because I am too, because you don't get through grad school without being a little bit OCD. So if you're the type of person that has to spend 20 minutes cleaning their glassware up before the end of a lab, that means you need to start 20 minutes before the end of lab, and so that you're done by the time that we're all supposed to leave. Are there any questions on any of the theory that we discussed today, or are there any questions on any aspect of the lab procedure itself? Then let's go ahead and get to work.